saving high school EMTs, collegiate EMS and alcohol consumption, insurance companies versus ambulance companies, and we're going to take a look at lidocaine in our tip of the week as we continue our series on anti-arrhythmic drugs. If that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on the MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the MediCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to the program this week. We have some good stuff coming up for you in our look at EMS in the news this week, plus a great tip of the week as we continue our series on medication administration and meds to review. But before I get into that, I do want to remind you of a couple of things. Head over to the MedicCast website over at mediccast.com/blog and check out all of the additional resources that are available over there, including the links to everything talked about in this and every other episode of the MedicCast. You can find it all over there. Right at the top of the page, there's a show notes link. Click the show notes link, and you can find all of the episode information there. If you want to get back in touch with me, I welcome you to do that. We've heard from a lot of individuals over the last couple of weeks about recent episodes, and I do respond to every email that comes in, so keep that contact coming in. You can send those emails in to me here at podmedic@mac.com. And I look forward to getting your emails, your comments, your questions, your suggestions, maybe even corrections if I've made a mistake. We want to make sure we get the best information out there. I consider this a community effort, folks, and I look forward to all of your input here at the MedicCast as well. Speaking of community efforts, coming up here in just about a month, we are going to be down at EMS World Expo in New Orleans producing our podcast and many other shows from the ProMed Network live from the exhibit hall floor. And I hope you'll join us there and accompany us for a couple of episodes. Sit in and listen to the episodes. There's going to be a social media lounge right next to our booth, and you can sit in a comfortable chair, charge up your phone, go ahead and hook into the free Wi-Fi we're going to provide for you, and check out the shows. We're going to be, MedicCast is going to be there, as well as the EMS Garage, the EMS Educast. I think we've got the EMS Research Podcast and PDU coming down. So all of your favorite podcasters are going to be there, and I look forward to seeing you. If you are in the area and not sure if you want to go or not, remember, we can get you free admission to the exhibit hall. Just go to emsworldexpo.com, and while you're there, fill out the information for an exhibit hall pass, and then when you go to checkout, use the promo code FP50, and that will get you a free exhibit hall pass. So go ahead through that process, and you can get in for free, and then we look forward to seeing you down at EMS World Expo coming up here in the end of October, so not that far away at all. First up in the news is a great article I picked up out of one of the local news sources in nearby Lebanon, Pennsylvania. And Elko High School there has one of the longest running, if not the longest running, high school EMT program in the country. It's been going on for 31 years. And with the retirement recently of the originator of that program, the school system thought they were going to have to close the program down. However, surrounding EMS services and many of them graduates of this program gathered together with volunteers and resources and funding to keep the program afloat. And paramedic Lauren Miller returned to the program to take on the role of lead instructor, teaching these young EMTs the skills they need to continue on in life and teaching them a valuable skill while they're still in high school. A lot of these people then run with their local volunteer services, help out, and when they graduate high school, they're EMTs, they're ready to get out there and begin working. And as Lauren did, many of them will probably continue on and become paramedics. So this is exciting, and these types of high school programs, I think, are a good indication of some of the ways we can reach out and teach about EMS in our communities. These students learn about EMS, therefore their families learn about EMS. The community is aware that there's a program like this, so there are opportunities to interact with the local government, with the local educators in the high school, and of course with all of the parents that may be interested in this program for their child. And it's an opportunity for us to continue to reach out to our public and educate them, along with educating new providers for the EMS systems. So I'm excited and really heartened to see that the local services gathered together to keep this program afloat. And I congratulate them and good luck to all of those EMT students that are perhaps there, some of them probably checking out the MedicCast right now. So I welcome you from Elko High School if you're checking this program out. And congratulations and good luck on your studies. Well, not only have high schools started up again, but most of the colleges are back in full session at this point. And many colleges have their own volunteer EMS services run by student organizations, and that's exciting to see. Also, there's a lot of things that happen at the beginning of the college years, especially for underage drinking issues. As colleges get back in session, especially with the freshman class, they're newly out of the house and out from under their parents' watchful eye, and these students are very likely to, if they haven't tried it before, give alcohol a shot in their early days in college. And unfortunately, in some cases, that can be a very dangerous prospect, causing alcohol poisoning, causing alcohol-related traumatic injury, and all of that is something that local EMS has to respond to. I found this article from Brown University talking about how programs that they have set up at the university to target underage drinking have paid back in a reduced number of responses they're seeing for their EMS system at Brown University. And that's interesting. And I think one of those very real returns on investment you can see for these types of public health education programs. You know, when somebody says to you, oh, you don't have to educate, we don't have to do education on teen pregnancy, or we don't have to do education on alcohol and drug abuse among teenagers, it doesn't work anyway. Well, here's an example of how just such a program works. If we can keep information in the forefront of teenagers' minds, because we all know where their minds go if we don't keep them full of other things, you end up with teenagers who haven't really thought about this in recent days, and they may not make good decisions. Now, this isn't going to stop the problem. It isn't going to make it completely go away, but certainly there are some in the system that, when educated and taught about such things, decided to make different decisions. Perhaps they chose to imbibe, but not imbibe to excess. Whatever the case may be, I think it's interesting to see these types of programs in action. And, you know, even if your local college or university, if you have one near your area that they don't have their own EMS service on campus, perhaps you can work with them to put together an alcohol and an education program and then track responses to that university or college and see if it makes a difference in the next area of next semester or whatever the next upcoming school break may be. I think these things are important, and I think it's important to team up with local organizations like colleges to not only search for resources like volunteer EMS professionals that you can educate and help with response, but also as an opportunity for you to reach out and lighten your load a little bit through a little bit of education and training. So in Massachusetts, there's a little bit of a war going on. Well, no, it's not the Continental Army fighting the Redcoats. No, not that. But there is a war going on right now between the Massachusetts Blue Cross Blue Shield organization and the local EMS organizations that are providing care. And it has to do with what the ambulance service is calling strong arm tactics to force ambulance services to become participating providers in the insurer's network. They're doing this by paying their patients directly. So an insurance company, instead of paying the ambulance service when they submit a bill, they're paying the patients and then telling the patients to go ahead and reimburse the ambulance service. I know we've seen this in our area and here in Maryland, and what has happened is often we know these patients have been paid, but we don't ever see a dime of it. They just cash the check and they never forward any of it onto the ambulance service. And this is happening in Massachusetts as well. So they're saying that this is the insurance companies are basically encouraging fraud and encouraging these people to run off with money that does not belong to them just by paying the patients directly rather than paying the ambulance service. They also indicate, and I tend to agree with this, this isn't costing the insurance companies any less money doing it this way. In fact, cutting checks like this one at a time to individual patients probably takes more time and effort on their part. And they're all doing this in many cases to try to force the ambulance services to become participating providers under their system, charging much, much lower rates than they can actually sustain to survive. And that's a difficult issue. So I wonder if this is going on in your area. Now, this is actually an editorial piece written by the New England General Manager for American Medical Response. AMR is a very large and mostly prosperous ambulance company in the United States that provides not only interfacility transport services in different areas, but also contracts with municipalities and local jurisdictions to provide 911-based EMS services. And AMR is saying that this is putting them out of business, and in certain communities are going to lose their ambulance services as a result because it's just no longer profitable to provide service in those communities. If the patients will not pay and will not forward at least the money they're getting from the insurance company on to the ambulance service to pay for their bill, then the ambulance services have no choice but to drop out of covering a given area. And I understand that. I mean, we just can't keep going and doing this for free, especially when it's a for-profit company that's out there under contract with a local jurisdiction. They just aren't going to be able to work in that jurisdiction anymore. So Massachusetts is looking at a way to combat this. I know in my region, I think Pennsylvania and Maryland has looked at doing this too, has enacted laws that basically say that if you are paid by your insurance company for a medical service and fail to forward that money on, that you can be charged with fraud, insurance fraud, that you have basically incorrectly filed for an insurance claim and then kept the money. So unfortunately for AMR in Massachusetts, this isn't the case at this time, and it's forcing them to reduce coverage area for EMS service in certain parts of the state. Next up, we'll be looking at lidocaine as our tip of the week this week and a medication review. We looked at amiodarone last week, and I thought I would continue on and look at another antiarrhythmic drug, often used, depending on where you are, interchangeably with amiodarone or substituted for amiodarone. I know in Maryland here, we've always used lidocaine, and our state medical director says that there's still no evidence that amiodarone is any more effective than lidocaine in treating ventricular arrhythmias. So we're going to continue to use the medication that's much cheaper to obtain, and that is lidocaine. So we're going to look at lidocaine here coming up in this episode's Med of the Week. So let's get on into this week's tip of the week and our review of lidocaine. We're going to look at the mechanism and class of this drug. We'll talk about contraindications and indications, side effects and precautions, interactions with other medications, and common dosages for this medication in this tip segment. So we've been talking about antiarrhythmic drugs, so no surprises. Guess what? Lidocaine is an antiarrhythmic. It's also a topical and local anesthetic, and depending on your EMS system, may be used in those in that realm. Sometimes some EMS systems may have lidocaine available for topical application, for instance, for nasotracheal intubation to facilitate passing of the tube through the nares and through the nasopharynx without too much pain and discomfort to the patient. It may also be used as a local anesthetic prior to the administration of something like an intraosseous injection site. It may also be used during an intraosseous bolus help deaden the nerves inside the bone if you're administering a bolus of medication directly into the IO output access point, you would need to anesthetize, or potentially could anesthetize, the nerves in the bone marrow to facilitate the intraosseous bolus that way. It also, as mechanism, suppresses ventricular response. Again, it's an anesthetic, so we're basically anesthetizing the heart muscle here and causing it to be less reactive, less automatic, you know, all of those aspects of cardiac muscle that we know. And it has a rapid onset. Within a minute or two, it will begin to see effects onset. And it lasts about a duration of about 10 to 20 minutes after use when we're talking about in terms of IV application. And that's a good thing. It's an intermediate effect drug, but it wears off relatively quickly in case we need to move to another medication. We use this primarily in the ACLS setting, and so, therefore, we're seeing it for use as an antiarrhythmic in place of something like amiodarone, V for VFib, pulseless VTAC, refractory to defibrillation. We may use it as a management drug after defibrillation to prevent return to these ventricular waveforms, but we're going to initially use it after that first shock. If it hasn't worked and they're still in VFib, VTAC, we're going to go ahead and administer this drug. It's also used for polymorphic VTAC with a pulse, a wide complex tachycardias, similar to what the amiodarone is used for. And it may also be used to suppress multifocal PVCs, although I include multiple multifocal PVCs here because we don't just treat an isolated PVC, right, folks? We want to make sure we're treating something that could potentially cause harm. So we're talking about runs, couplets and triplets of PVCs, multifocal PVCs going through, because that basically is the beginning of what's going to become a VTAC or could progress directly to ventricular fibrillation. Again, it's that multifocal nature of it. It may be used, as I said, for nasal intubation, IO infusion anesthetic, and other local anesthetic purposes. Contraindications, any patient with an AV block, we're not going to give this medication to them. The reason for that is because we don't want to suppress ventricular activity in a patient whose only pacemaker is located in the ventricles. Does that make sense? We don't want a patient that could either has a complete heart block or could progress rapidly to a complete heart block to lose their ability to pacemake their own heart, right? To apply that pacing to their own heart. So if they're not getting their heartbeat from a secure atrial location, we don't want to suppress the ventricles. And that's why we say that. Sensitivity to the drug, just like any drug, if they have an allergy to lidocaine in the past, and they may know that as something like a medication that they've received as a local anesthetic, if they've had a reaction to that severe reaction, it may be contraindicated. Patients who've had idioventricular escape rhythm, and this is related back to the AV block, we need to recognize where the rhythm is located and where it's receiving its signals. And if we're seeing an idioventricular escape rhythm, we do not want to suppress that with lidocaine. Bradycardia, hypotension are both, of course, related to cardiac output. As we talked about the numbers of cardiology a little while ago, we want to be thinking about cardiac output. And again, anything that's going to lower cardiac output is going to further compromise the system. So if the patient is already hypotensive and bradycardic, we might want to look at another resource to manage the patient's arrhythmia. Of course, you can always consult with medical control and see what they recommend, but we definitely want to manage these patients carefully. Patients with ventricular conduction defects, again, this just relates back to the whole cardiac conduction system. We want to make sure we're protecting the patient's ability to maintain their own heart rate and pulse, because even if it's ugly, it's theirs, and it's a lot more effective than CPR is. So we want to make sure that we protect that ability and not take it away from them inappropriately. Side effects include lightheadedness, confusion. The patient might experience slurred speech or blurred vision. They also could experience an altered level of consciousness as that confusion and lightheadedness occurs. They may also experience seizures as a result of this. Temporary hearing loss has been reported. And in the rhythm, you might see a prolonged P to R interval. And think about it, that's that slowing of the ventricular response. So if you see a long P to R, a lengthened P to R interval, that is a sign that the lidocaine is having its effect. You want to monitor that carefully because you don't want to too quickly suppress the ventricular response or suppress it to the point that the P to R interval, you know, becomes infinite, right? That's a bad thing. What precautions can we take? Well, we want to make sure we're maintaining, thinking about reduced dosing of this drug in elderly patients, cardiac compromised patients, and patients with reduced liver function. We also want to consider giving boluses over 1 minute, except in cases of VFib and VTAC. So if we're using this in the ACLS setting in VFib, VTAC, we want to give this as an IV push. Otherwise, we might give it in a slow IV push bolus over time for something like PVCs. Okay, keep that in mind. Drug interactions, you'll see prolonged effects with patients that are taking beta blockers. They also see prolonged effects with a patient who's received epinephrine. So this might last a little bit longer if you've already got epi on board on this patient. And the reason for that is it's constricting the constricting the blood vessels, which is reducing blood flow back to the liver, which is how we clear lidocaine out of the system. So anything that slows the progression of the drug to the metabolizer, the liver, is going to end up suppressing and maintaining more of the drug in the system on board. Beta blockers, the same thing. Really suppressing cardiac output with the beta blockers is going to slow the clearing of this drug. And so you may see prolonged effects with that. Patients with reduced liver functions aren't clearing the drug. They're going to have prolonged effects as well. And this includes prolonged effects for the local anesthetic application or the topical anesthetic application. So this is all relevant. Patients may experience apnea in large doses when they've received succinylcholine. So keep that in mind as a side effect with if you're going to RSI a patient that you've already got lidocaine on board. Please refer to your protocols and check with medical control if you're not sure on whether or not sux is the right drug for snowing that patient. You just want to keep that in mind. And additive neurological effects with procainamide, and basically a related drug, lidocaine and procainamide are related. And so you can have some additive effects with those two drugs, and you'll see neurological effects, the more of the confusion, more of the altered level of consciousness, more of the dizziness, lightheadedness, and things like that. So when you do see some kind of toxicity with lidocaine, it's often more evident in the neurological effects that you might see. So if you've got a neurologically intact patient and they start having an altered level of consciousness, there may be an indication if you've been giving them like a lidocaine drip over time, it might be an indication to slow up that drip a little bit and see if you can get them back, see what's going on with the patient. Common dosages for VFib and pulseless VTAC in an adult, 1.5 milligrams per kilogram IV push or IO. Additional dose of 1.5 milligrams per kilogram in 3 to 5 minutes, and you give them a maximum total dose of what? That's right, 3 milligrams per kilogram is the maximum total dose. So in the case of VFib and pulseless VTAC, you're giving them 2 doses of this drug. If you're talking about pediatric patients and VFib, pulseless VTAC, my protocols in Maryland are saying, and I think everyone's do the same, 1 milligram per kilogram IV push or intraosseous, additional dose of 1 milligram per kilogram every 3 to 5 minutes, up to 3 milligrams per kilogram. So you could give up to 3 doses of this to a patient. With a pulse, VTAC with a pulse in adults, 1 to 1.5 milligrams per kilogram in the initial dose IV push or IO, and then additional doses of 0.5 to 0.75 milligrams per kilogram every 3 to 5 minutes. And again, that's up to that maximum of 3 milligrams per kilogram, but you're going to have to make sure you keep careful track of what you've given and how much in this patient, because we don't want to extend into the toxicity range for these patients in this situation. Pediatric patients, VTAC with a pulse, 1 milligram per kilogram, IV push or IO, additional doses of 0.5 milligrams per kilogram every 3 to 5 minutes, up to the max of 3 milligrams per kilogram. If you're looking at IO infusion anesthetic in an adult, you might want to administer 20 to 40 milligrams of lidocaine IO prior to your infusion, your pressure infusion. Remember, it's an enclosed space, and so you've got to usually have to put a blood pressure cuff or some kind of pump on the infusion via IO, because it's hard to get the fluids to flow into the bone space. So in the intraosseous space, we can deaden some of the nerve response because they're going to feel some pressure down there with lidocaine, and the dose would be 20 to 40 milligrams IO. Again, refer to your protocols for what's appropriate. If you're giving this to a pediatric patient, an IO patient, you'll want to consult with medical control for the appropriate dose for pediatrics. There's a lot of additional resources. Of course, I use the Maryland EMS protocols. We have a statewide protocol here, and that's what I've used for a lot of the things like dosages and usages here. But I have brought up some of the other things. You can find the Maryland EMS protocols at MIMS.org. You can also look at the jointemsprotocols.com site, which has a lot of information on various EMS protocols and tries to consolidate it all into one giant protocol. You can check that out. And of course, I always refer sometimes, or not always, but sometimes go to Wikipedia if it looks like they've got their head on straight, and I've looked at the resource links. So I've received some of the information for this segment from Wikipedia in their entry on lidocaine. If you want additional resource links and you want to follow up on exactly where I got my information, you can find those links in the show notes for this episode. And I hope you enjoyed this review of lidocaine as our tip of the week. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the program this week and remind you to please head over and check out all of the resources you'll find over at the MedicCast website. That's at MedicCast.com/blog. While you're over there, you can find the links for show notes at the top of the page. There's contact information there. There's a place to sign up for our MedicCast newsletter and get all the links and information sent to you by email every week. And of course, a whole lot more articles posted throughout the week, links to our Facebook page, to my Twitter account, whatever else you need. Go ahead over there to the MedicCast blog and check in on the information there. If you'd like to get back in touch with me, I always look forward to hearing from you. You can send those emails in to me at podmedic@mac.com. I look forward to hearing from each and every one of you, and I do respond to every email. So please keep those emails coming in. I've got quite a few great emails recently from listeners telling me about where they are in school, what they've done, how they use the MedicCast to help them study or stay up to date on things. And hey, that makes me feel really good, especially when I'm having a week where I just don't feel like recording the show, which happens sometimes. It's really heartening to hear from you and understand that you all are looking forward to another episode. So keep those emails coming in. If you'd like to get back in touch with me on Twitter or Facebook or some other social media avenue, you can find me most places under the handle PodMedic. So if you look up twitter.com/PodMedic, facebook.com/PodMedic, you'll find me there. And don't forget the MedicCast fan page over on Facebook. You can find that at facebook.com/MedicCast. Go ahead and click the like button on that page and become an official fan of the MedicCast. We have over, I think, 3,200 fans over on that page right now. And that's exciting to see that, because it means that there's just a lot of people getting information from the MedicCast each and every week. I post additional articles that never make it into the show on that page throughout the week. Videos, articles, and all kinds of information, questions for the audience and community, and you can find all of that over at facebook.com/MedicCast. That's it for me. I do want to make sure you remember that we are going to be at EMS World Expo and that you can get access to a free admission to the exhibit hall. And you can get that pass at emsworldexpo.com and use the promo code FP50 when you check out and get that free exhibit hall pass. If you want to come by, listen to the podcast that we're going to be doing live from the exhibit hall all day, all three of those days. Come on down to EMS World Expo in New Orleans beginning on October 31st, Halloween. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. I'll be back soon with another episode here of the MedicCast. We release them every single Monday. In the meantime, please remember, people, scene safety, BSI.